John Calvin last week, but we were providentially hindered from so doing by the failure of technology and the lack of redundancy on my part. And so we have, well, actually, let's see here. Oh, yeah, Kelly's teaching, so I can tell a story. gentlemen, this is a good example. I had purchased this for Kelly, and it had all the accoutrements and everything. And basically, the only thing we were using it for was to kill batteries. You put batteries in these, and they slowly go down. And then you put new batteries in them, and they would slowly go down. And meanwhile, it wasn't doing anything. It was just killing batteries. So she agreed that it would probably be a better use. I would get significantly more use out of it. So the nice thing with these is, since they had the similar operating system, it was just a matter of putting it into a different cradle and going, you're a new one, and it just reloads everything on it, including all of our notes for the study this morning. So I have everything right here before me, and that's a good thing. Now, for those of you visiting with us, no, we don't we don't sit around and would you like me to beam you the notes, Mr. Chris? You don't know how to beam? Oh man, that's like owning a Lamborghini and not knowing how to get out of second gear. Okay? I mean, why in the world have the technology if you can't? Actually, I'd have to beam you more than just the thing here. But anyways, but I could, and you could have these notes. Yes, and beaming is very simple. But I won't press that any farther. Anyways, if you are, some folks who visit with us frequently will come into the fellowship and are somewhat surprised if the topic of discussion, the sermon, isn't one of the 5 points. Or if the Bible study isn't on John Calvin or something. It's actually very rare. In fact, I think this is the first time I've done a Bible study on the life of John Calvin, but it's part of church history. We've also discussed all sorts of other elements of church history, from the origins of purgatory to persecution in the early church and the fall of the Roman Empire and everything else. It just so happens this is the subject that we have come to in our studies. And in wrapping up the amount of church history we're going to do, but it's also relevant to the time I mentioned last week. For example, the issue of Dave Hunt's new book and how it just rips and shreds on John Calvin. And so, unfortunately, what we frequently have to do is when you mention a biblical doctrine, you may mention the fact that the term predestination occurs in the book of Ephesians or the book of Romans. And for many people, automatically the response to that is, well, yeah, but did you know John Calvin was a nasty guy? Now, obviously, there's some major league disconnections between your statement that the term predestination appears in Ephesians chapter 1 and the response that John Calvin was a nasty guy. And in fact, I think Mr. Callahan could confirm for us, having taught logic many times in the past, that it would probably be fairly difficult for someone to actually, using symbolic logic, make a demonstration that the one statement has anything whatsoever to do with the other. But that is the kind of situation that we face, and if you say, well, I've never had anybody say that to me, I have. In fact, Mr. Pierce can tell you, having looked at our email, that it's the norm, not the exception, to get that kind of not overly logical response. And so there are times when it is good to have a general level of knowledge about some people in history, and when we deal with such things as God's sovereign grace, the term Calvinism is very frequently raised, and hence John Calvin comes up as well. And so knowing a little bit something about his life would be rather rather helpful. Putting ourselves back into our timeline and having some knowledge of where we are, remember, 1466, okay. 1466, we have the birth of Erasmus, and we've talked about Erasmus before and his extreme importance to the development of Reformation theology and so on and so forth. 1483, we have Luther. Just giving you some context here. Zwingli is 1484, so they're very close to each other here. And normally you hear Luther, Zwingli, Calvin, but Luther has entered in 1507. He has entered the monastery already. And then 1509, you have Calvin's birth. So Luther is a young man. Calvin is really a second generation reformer. His birthday, if you're wondering, is July 10th, and he is born in Noyon, France. And so he really, as we will see, his conversion and his ministry is in the second generation. Now, the work was still so large, it had such a great amount of work to do that there was still, in some ways, it wasn't like he was building upon what others had already done. There were still plenty of places where, even at his period of time, put his ministry beginning in the middle 1530s, which is, 13, 14, 15 years after Luther has already gotten started, actually a little bit more than that, about 17 years after Luther's gotten started. Still, in many areas, you were the first generation even at that point. And certainly in Geneva, he did the work of a first-generation reformer there. But there was a little history now. There was Luther had already stood before Charles. That had already taken place. There was already some water under the bridge, so to speak, when Calvin begins his ministry. And so we've already looked at Luther and Zwingli and things like that. We know that the debates had already taken place. And in 1523, focusing primarily on Calvin here now, in 1523, Calvin goes to Paris to study. So he's a young man, of course. He's only about 14 years of age when he goes off to Paris to begin his higher education. And Paris is going to be extremely important in Calvin's life. From 1523 to 1528, he is engaged in study there in Paris, and then in 1528 he goes to Orléans, which we would, in our language, pronounce as Orleans, or as in New Orleans, or New Orleans, if you go down there and actually talk to those folks. I've only been there once, and it rained every single second I was there. 19 inches a few days I was there. It was just lots of fun. And only after I was there did I find out that it's actually below sea level. So if the dams and the dikes ever break, that whole thing's gonna become a big old swimming pool. But anyways, when I got back, man, I took my clothes out of my bag, and they were like I had never dried them. I mean, they were the humidity. Oh, it can be raining cats and dogs outside. It never gets that humid here. I mean, it is just unbelievable. Some of you know exactly what I'm talking about. And when I came back, that's when I said, I'm never complaining about the humidity again. Well, I probably will, but, that's how it is. Anyhow, that's not where Calvin went, in case anyone was worried about this. This is the old Orleans, you might say. He goes to Orléans for a little while, and then he moves between some schools as he is studying law. And so there is an interesting connection there, and that is Luther was sort of pre-law in his study as well, and Calvin likewise did study law. So here you have Calvin. He's still, the French Reformation really has not begun yet. 1528, he's studying law, and 1529 is when the Marburg Colloquy is taking place. And so all this stuff has already taken place. You've already got Luther and Zwingli trying to agree on elements of doctrine, and Calvin's not even in the picture. He's not even converted yet. That's why one of the issues of emphasizing the second-generation nature of Calvin's ministry. 1531, Calvin doesn't have any realization of the importance of this date in his life until much later, but it's sort of like, you know, you see, you know, when you track the course of the Titanic or something, you know, they missed their turn by 10 miles, and that's why they ran into an iceberg and stuff like that. Things come together and end up being very important. A fellow by the name of Miguel Servetus publishes a book in 1531, anonymously, of course, because he knew that it was heretical, entitled On the Errors of the Trinity. Now, we will, of course, run into Servetus in the future of Calvin's life. Servetus is a Spaniard, a brilliant man, sort of akin, I would say, to some people that I know that are so brilliant that they're not really stable. There's a brilliance that results in sort of a level of insanity. Some people actually credit him. He had something to do with the discovery of the circulatory system and things relevant to it, so he was a medical doctor. But he also had a fascination with issues of philosophy, and Servetus held to a sort of modalistic view of the Trinity. No one has really ever held a view identical to his, which is not overly uncommon, but this book on Errors of the Trinity was written not in a dispassionate academic sense. Then again, very few books were written in a dispassionate academic sense at that particular point in time. But it was rather vile in its language. He did not have any difficulties really ripping and shredding on those who would oppose him. But of course, he's writing knowing that if he were ever to be captured in Catholic lands, or really probably in any lands at all, whether Catholic or Protestant, that writing such a book as this would result in his execution. Yes, sir. Well, yeah. I mean, the Moors, you mean? Well, you have the Moors. I mean, you know, the Islamic expansion had entered into that area centuries and centuries before. And so now you had more of a, you had a cultural version of it. And then at the turn of the millennium, Averro and his influence is all across Europe. So... but yeah, there's definitely, you know, that was many centuries before this, and there's still a strong emphasis there. Though, of course, in the Roman Catholic area of the in Spain itself, Roman Catholicism is still very much the religion of the empire, and hence Islam would be opposed to that. I don't know of any, I've never read anything that said Servetus himself had any influence from Islam. Yeah, they're still there to this day. So the Inquisition is not quite as much of a force at this time as it had been in the preceding two or three centuries. But it's still there, and there's still executions going on with a fair amount of regularity, just not quite as regular as it had been. And we will see that Servetus is arrested and is tried and is scheduled to be executed by the Inquisition, by the Roman Catholic Inquisition. And the night before his execution, he escapes and heads to Geneva, as we will see. So... But it was more cultural at that point. I would say there was still, you know, it was cultural, but you had to externally conform to the official religion of Spain at that particular point in time. There would be areas, of course, as this is the case in every situation, there would be areas where, since it was primarily a local duty to enforce said laws, that if you had a large minority in a particular area, you probably wouldn't be enforcing those laws. You know, so it could go on in certain areas, whereas it might not be able to in others. Same year, 1531, Calvin's father dies, and it was indeed Calvin's father who had been pushing him in the direction of the study of law, which again sounds familiar. That's the same thing we had with Luther. And Calvin's interests are more in history and academic studies of the early church fathers and things like that. And in fact, in the next year, 1532, Calvin's first published work comes out. So 1532, so he's 23 years old. He's 23 years old when he writes a commentary on Seneca's De Clementia, and it appears in Paris April 4th of 1532. So he's about 23 years old when he first publishes his work. Obviously not exactly the kind of work that's going to be discussed on every street corner in Paris. It's an academic work. It's a dry academic work. I mean, it's not, you know, how can you get overly excited about it? Those who would review it today would say that for its day, it showed a keen mind, good research, good use of sources, that kind of thing. But his conversion has not yet taken place. Now, it is interesting to note that when Calvin goes to Paris to study, and during this period of time, he is receiving a benefice. And what is that? Well, a benefice was clergy stipend is what it was. And how it functioned for him, in essence, was he was given the position of a minor cleric in the church, as I recall, back in Nyon. It could be, I don't remember the exact location, but that was my recollection anyways, off the top of my head. And it would provide a certain amount of money. It was the equivalent in that day of our scholarship today, but it was religious in nature. And sometimes folks will refer to this, see, he was involved with, you know, he was a cleric and so on, and he was, in a very minor role at this particular point in time. Now, the issue of Calvin's conversion is very interesting. He certainly doesn't fit into modern evangelical molds in the sense that his writings are filled with references to that one day when on such and such a day at such and such a time I walked an aisle and shook a hand and so on and so forth. In fact, you will pretty much search in vain through the vast majority of church history for that kind of an understanding of regeneration and conversion. Basically, we are left only with there's a commentary in the Psalms where Calvin makes reference to this sudden breaking in of God's truth upon his life, and this radical coming to understand the gospel and things like that. But he doesn't get overly specific. He just makes reference to this. And there's a tremendous amount of argumentation. You can go read all the books. The scholars basically range from anywhere from 31 to as late as 1534 for the dating of this conversion experience. That may be one of the problems, is trying to put a date on something that Calvin himself didn't, in the sense of wanting to put a day, an hour, maybe a particular week or something, when, you know, we can even read Spurgeon. Spurgeon talks about this length of time, this period of time when he was greatly troubled of soul and is crying out to God and so on and so forth. Of course, again, I mentioned this in passing, I have seen criticisms of all of Calvinism, and Calvin in specific, based upon this. There are certain groups that say, look, if you can't give us the altar call card that you were supposed to have received and you prayed the sinner's prayer, then you're probably not a Christian. And since Calvin doesn't ever reproduce his altar call card, then we have good reason to believe he wasn't a believer. Of course, that would also mean that there weren't any Christians prior about the 1800s, but that kind of inconsistency doesn't really bother a whole lot of folks to use that kind of argumentation anyway. But that comes up, and it is interesting to read the various and sundry discussions. All we know that is in 1533, Calvin and a man by the name of Nicholas Kopp flee Paris. Now, why they flee Paris? Well, because something had appeared there on the campus in the school at Paris that was promoting what can only be described as Reformed or Protestant teaching and belief. And Calvin and Kopp flee Paris after its appearance. Now, why they would flee if they had nothing to do with it, nobody can really suggest. And so most feel that something's going on here in 1533 that would indicate a change of perspective. And you got to realize, to publish something that would promote Protestant thinking in Paris at that time, it takes a fair amount of guts. I mean, it's not like you just decided one day, I've sort of changed my view a little bit. No, if you change your view and you're putting yourself in mortal danger, you've got to have some pretty strong convictions already laid down to be willing to put something out that would cause you to have to flee Paris. For fear of ending up in a dungeon someplace, in essence. And so this particular action is what makes most people feel that sometime before 1533, probably in 1532, 1531, this change has taken place in the life of John Calvin. Now, it's also very interesting that about 3 years later, in 1534, this guy pops up for the first time in Calvin's life, and I hardly ever, in fact, I've not seen, and I need to look more closely at the discussion of the Calvin and Servetus incident, but I'm pretty confident this doesn't appear in Mr. Hunt's recent book. This particular incident just gets ignored constantly, and I remember when I had a debate with Dr. Robert Sabin in 1999 on Long Island, on oneness theology. He spent the first 20-some-odd minutes of his opening statement attacking Calvin for the issue of Servetus without ever getting to the subject of the debate. And when I got back up, since I had very little to respond to, I did at least respond while he left out of the his presentation. This was one of the issues I brought up. Yes, sir? No, I didn't mention where he went. I don't have that in my notes at the moment. He's I think in the countryside. I think he's still in France at the time, but I could be wrong about that. In 1534, somehow, and we're not certain of how this took place, Servetus contacts Calvin. He contacts this young, relatively unknown scholar. Maybe he had run across his commentary on Seneca. I don't know. But Servetus, who is also went under the name of Michael Villanueva, that was his public name, because if he couldn't go under your name Servetus when you'd published a book against the errors of Trinity, on the errors of Trinity. He somehow is fascinated with the person of John Calvin. There's some sort of very unhealthy fascination that he has with this man. Personally, and I can't prove this, but personally, I think Servetus, I've met people like Servetus before. I know how they think. I know how they operate. and they are fascinated by an intellect that they think might be equal to or superior to their own. They find such people to be challenging, and they develop a very unhealthy, fatal attraction, shall we say, for people like that. And what's interesting is that here in 1534, now Calvin has fled Paris. Servetus goes to the effort of contacting him, and he wants to meet with him in Paris. Calvin, for some reason, and he doesn't really comment a whole lot on these things, but Calvin, for some reason, agrees to meet with him and sneaks back into Paris to try to meet with this man, Miguel Servetus, and Servetus just doesn't show up. Calvin waits. Appointed time comes and goes. Man never shows. Calvin has to sneak back out of Paris. And so a couple of things across my mind at this point, and you might be going, what is this Servetus guy? Well, if you're not familiar with him, you'll run into him a little bit later. Trust me, there is a reason for all this. Seemingly, as I see it, at this point in time, Calvin is firm enough in his convictions and dedicated to his convictions, so much to the point where, A, he will engage in publishing something that is would be considered to be illegal, and would get him in trouble, and also has that attitude that we see, which is constantly ignored in the literature that just seeks to lambaste him. And that is, he really had a deep sense of pastoral commitment. This was seen later in Strasbourg when he has a small French congregation in Strasbourg and the plague hits. And Calvin didn't do as many did in those days and go off and have a vacation someplace else until the plague ran its course in Strasbourg. That was the only way to get out of such a situation. Once the plague started in there, you left. He didn't, and he ministered to his flock right through the plague. This was only a few years later. So it seems to me that here is this man. He has theological questions. He sees in Calvin, for some reason, an intellect equal to or greater than his own. Calvin risks his life, in essence, to try to minister to the man never shows. He will, about 15, 16 years later, but he doesn't at that time. Actually, more than 20 years later. Anyways, in this same period of time, Calvin visits a man who might be described as a proto-reformer in France, Lefebvre. And evidently, and again, this is like I said, scholars argue, some will place his conversion as late as 1534, around the same period of time, because they'll say, well, you know, just because he fled was because he just knew who Nicholas Kopp was. He felt he'd get in trouble, so that's why he fled, so on and so forth. There's a lot of argumentation about it, but no matter what, the absolute end time, latest date for his conversion, after he visits Lefebvre, he resigns his benefices and leaves that whole part of his life behind. He is no longer going to be associated in any way, shape, or form with the church, at least the Roman Catholic Church. Seemingly, he learns from Lefebvre that Lefebvre was sort of like Erasmus. He was trying to work for reform within the church. And seemingly, he gets from this conversation, it's not going to happen. There's just issues have gone too far. There's really no openness to this kind of reform taking place. Now, here's the amazing thing. That's toward, yes, sir. That's in 1534. I'm just going with general dates here. That's probably early to mid 1534, somewhere around in there. Now, what is amazing is He leaves France, and in 1536 in Basel, Switzerland. So this is only, it's less than, it's 2 years later at the max. Let's put it that way. 24 months pass by. And in March of 1536, so it's actually less than 24 months, March of 1536, the first edition of Calvin's Institutes are published in Basel, Switzerland. Now, if you're not familiar with Calvin's Institutes, the edition that may even be in the book room in the back, I'm not sure, most of us are familiar with Calvin's Institutes, probably the most significant Reformation writing as far as if you just sort of back off and look, all right, what works have influenced a larger number of people, even if they were not directly in the line of Calvin, than any other work written during the Reformation. And, you know, you've got books like Pilgrim's Progress, and you've got Luther's works, and you've got all the rest of these things. But really, probably, if you just sort of back off and look at it, probably the Institutes, most influential over time. The first edition of the Institutes is written very shortly. I mean, no matter what you, how, where you put all the dates, very shortly after Calvin makes his break with the Roman Church. Now, most of us have not read the first edition of the Institutes. I have it, but the edition you've probably seen, the two-volume paperback or the two-volume hardback that is available, is the 1559 edition. So the work went through a number of editions, and really it in essence is Calvin's systematic theology, sort of. It didn't start that way. The original Institutes, the edition of the original edition of the Institutes, really was meant by Calvin. It included a lengthy appeal to the King of France for religious liberty. It was meant as an apologetic work. It was meant to defend the developing Protestant movement from all the accusations being made against it, to demonstrate that it was biblical, that it was historical. Remember, Calvin studied the early church fathers. His first published work was on Seneca, and so he knew how to use the writings, the ancient writings. He knew how to do research in them, and shows a broad knowledge of the early church fathers in the text of the Institutes. And so what he was basically saying was, look, this is not something new. We aren't a bunch of radicals who come up with something no one's ever thought of before. This is the ancient gospel, but it's been perverted, and it's been covered over in the traditions of men, and we have a legitimate right to go back to what was believed before all these accretions took place over time. And so really it was meant as an appeal to say, we have a legitimate right to do what we are doing. Later in that year, it's interesting, Calvin goes to Farrar. He eventually struck up a friendship with some Italian royalty, which was quite interesting, and especially given Italy is not exactly a safe place to be if you're a Protestant. And then later in the year, he returns to Paris briefly under a temporary amnesty. The King of France declared a temporary amnesty, and he returns to Paris for a brief period of time during that summer. But it is a very temporary amnesty, and it comes to a crashing end, and so he and anyone else like him needs to flee from France. And so it's fascinating. I wish, at this point, I wish we had a map. I should have, someday I'm gonna put a map on my laptop so I can project it so you can see this, because it's really, really, really interesting when you know the story and when you know what ends up happening. Calvin was not a big buff guy. He wasn't a person who really liked being in the spotlight. you read his writings, and basically what he wanted to do is he wanted to be a scholar. I mean, he wanted to, you know, sort of live in a library and write books. You know, I mean, if he could have gotten away with a quiet life of scholarship like that, he would have. So he decided to leave France and to go to Strasbourg. Strasbourg was a free city, and excellent universities, hence big libraries, and he just wanted to go live a quiet life and be a scholar. He had no concept whatsoever of becoming a reformer in the sense of leading and being out front and having to deal every day with all the issues that would come up when trying to lead a reformation in a particular area. And there was a direct route to Strasbourg, but he couldn't go that way because there happened to be a battle going on. And the road was closed because there were a bunch of people killing each other down the road, basically. And so he had to take a more of a circuitous route down through Switzerland. And the road that he would eventually take him to Strasbourg passed through the city of Geneva. And those of you who've read the story know it's a fascinating story. He is traveling very quietly. He's not in some fancy carriage or something. He's walking. And stops at the inn in Geneva. And signs in at the hotel. And he's recognized because he wrote the Institutes. And the Institutes of the Christian Religion were getting around. The book was being distributed. And you see, Geneva at this time was in an uproar. The Reformation was taking place in Geneva. And Geneva was in danger. The whole social fabric was in upheaval at the time, in fact, from these issues. And Geneva had broken from the Roman Catholic Church and had basically kicked Cardinal Sadoleto, and actually Sadoleto's chosen bishop, out of Geneva. There were, to use apocalyptic language, wars and rumors of wars all over the place. And not only that, but the Genevans were proving to be somewhat of a recalcitrant people, and the fellow who was in charge of the Reformation in Geneva was Guillaume Farel. And William Farel in English. Fiery, emotional preacher. Red-haired fella. And he could preach with the best of them, but he wasn't much of an organizer. He wasn't much of a leader in that sense. He could lead with passion, but he was a lot of passion, but not as much substance as he recognized he needed in this city of Geneva. So to make a long story short, the fact that the author of the Institutes, which Farel had seen, had just checked into the hotel, comes to Farrell's attention. And that night he goes to visit this still very young, this is still a very young man, impressionable man. And Calvin tells the story later that this big red-haired man comes to his room and begins to talk to him very gruffly, very roughly. And in no uncertain terms, Farel informs this young man that he is to stay in Geneva and he is to join with Farel in bringing the Reformation to this city, and that God would damn his studies if he left. And I can just see this, I can just, can you picture this? You know, I mean, you know, sort of at the local Motel 6, you know, and knock, 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 and God has called you to minister here. Ah! You know, you can just see this poor little scholarly guy shriveling up in a ball in the corner, you know. And Calvin's just blown away. I mean, he doesn't know what to do, but Farrell's successful. And, I mean, Calvin's basically scared to death to get back on the road to Strasbourg for being struck dead by a bolt of lightning. I mean, Farrell's a convincing dude. And so, as I recall, he had already had his belongings sent ahead of him. He was just walking himself, so he has to, you know, make arrangements and have that stuff sent to Geneva. But that's how Calvin came to be in Geneva the first time, was through the encounter that he has with Farrell in early August of 1536. And he's only going to be there 2 years before he and Farrell are quite literally ridden out of town on a rail. But you go, well, he's called the Genevan Reformer. Yeah, well, he comes back later and ends up living the rest of his life there. But the next number of years, the next 2 years, are some of the most difficult in Calvin's life. He's made to be there when he doesn't want to be. And what's more is the Genevans don't want him there. He's a foreigner. He's too strict. And we'll pick up with that whole section of the story next week. Okay? All right, let's close our time with a word of prayer. Lord, we thank you for this time you give to us to study and to learn. We ask that you would help us to remember those things that are important to us, that we might be able to be better servants of yours. We ask now that you would be with us as we go into the services, that you would help us to sing and to pray in a way that is pleasing in your sight. Lord, help us to do the work of worship this morning. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.